Happy Thanksgiving from Clay Travis, Buck Sexton, and everyone here at the EIB Network. Thanksgiving traditions on the EIB Network included Rush Limbaugh's rendition of the first real Thanksgiving in America. That tradition continues with the rebroadcast of Rush's rendition here on the EIB Network.
One of the challenging aspects of losing someone are those first-year firsts, a birthday that's not celebrated, a holiday that's not shared, an anniversary that passes. If you were with us yesterday, James Golden, or as many of you know him, Bo Snerdly, spoke with us about a special tradition that Rush always shared on the eve of Thanksgiving.
It was a great tradition, and we recognize this year might be difficult for those of you who always looked forward to it. So in an effort to make this first holiday a bit easier, we decided to revisit Rush's tradition with you today. We hope this brings some happy memories and comfort.
So the real story of Thanksgiving, it is a tradition on this program. And this is the time of year, to me, the holiday season begins, and I think to most people. And this time of year, I just become overwhelmed with so many emotions, memories, and the way I'm built, most of my memories are positive. I think in my case, when I think of nostalgia or the past, the things that automatically occur to me are pleasant ones. It takes me to the true story of Thanksgiving. It was written about in Chapter 6 of See, I Told You So, Book 2. It's the chapter titled Dead White Guys or What the History Books Never Tell You. And this chapter, by the way, served as the foundation for the first book in the Rush Revere series, Rush Revere and the Brave Pilgrims, where in addition to the true story of Thanksgiving, we have the true story of the Pilgrims, who they were, where they came from, why they came, what happened when they got here, what they had to do to fix what went wrong when they got here, and what role the Pilgrims play in the overall founding of America. Rush Revere and the Brave Pilgrims, that's the first book of five in the Rush Revere Time Travel Adventures with Exceptional Americans series, which is written for young people. Why did the Pilgrims risk everything to get on a rickety little ship? Compared to ships and boats today, it was a rickety little thing. They traveled the Atlantic Ocean to a place that was foreign and unknown, and they were on a boat that the last thing about it was pleasant or luxury. They had no idea what they were going to encounter, but it had to be better than what they were fleeing. And what they were fleeing was religious persecution. Now, the real story of Thanksgiving, and I wasn't even taught the whole version. Like everybody, I was taught a sanitized modern version that has elements of political correctness and multiculturalism, isn't it? I was taught that Thanksgiving was about the Pilgrims being saved from starvation and deprivation by the loving, good-hearted, compassionate, and caring stewards of the earth, the Indians. The Pilgrims didn't know how to grow corn, food, maize, popcorn, anything of the sort when they got here. The Indians showed them all of that. And Thanksgiving was the Pilgrims inviting the Indians over for dinner to thank the Indians for saving them, the Native Americans. Everybody's been taught a version of that, but, ladies and gentlemen, it isn't true. The story of the Pilgrims begins in the early part of the 17th century. For those of you in Rio Linda, that would be the 1600s. The Church of England under King James was persecuting anybody and everybody who did not recognize its absolute civil and spiritual authority. The government was God. The government was the religion. The government was the church. And those who challenged that, those who believed strongly in freedom of worship, were hunted down. They were imprisoned and sometimes executed for their religious beliefs in 1600s England. So a group of separatists, people that didn't want any part of this, they'd had it their limit, first fled to Holland. That's right, the Pilgrims did not come on the same route as the Titanic. They didn't come from England. They fled to Holland, and they established a community there. And after 11 years, 40 of them agreed to make the journey to what was then called the New World, where they knew they would certainly face hardships. But the promise was that they could live and worship God according to the dictates of their own consciences. The belief in freedom of religion to engage in this kind of activity in order to be able to do it, to be able to cross an ocean to a place you have no idea what to expect, just to be able to worship as you choose. So August 1st, 1620, the Mayflower set sail. There were 102 passengers, including 40 pilgrims. The whole ship was not pilgrims, 40 of them. They were led by a man named William Bradford. And on the journey, Bradford set up an agreement, a contract, that established, well, what it was socialism. Just and equal laws for all members of the new community, quote unquote, irrespective of their religious beliefs. Where did the revolutionary ideas expressed in the Mayflower Compact come from? These are religious people. They came from the Bible. The pilgrims were a people that were completely steeped in the lessons of the Old and New Testaments. And the pilgrims looked to the ancient Israelites for their example, and because of the biblical precedents in Scripture, they didn't doubt their experiment would work. They were people with incredible faith. The journey to the New World was long. It was arduous. When they landed in New England in November, according to Bradford's journal, they found a cold, barren, desolate wilderness. No friends to greet them. No dock. No Motel 6. No gas stations. No strip. Nothing. Rocks and coastline. No houses. There were no hotels, no inns, and the sacrifice they had made for freedom was just beginning. During the first winter, half of them died, including William Bradford's own wife, of either starvation, sickness, or exposure. When spring finally came, Indians, Native Americans, did indeed teach the settlers how to plant corn, how to fish for cod, skin beavers for coats. Life improved for the pilgrims, but they didn't prosper. Not yet. Now, this is important to understand because this is where modern American history lessons end. This is what the modern Thanksgiving story is. Pilgrims show up, don't know what they're doing, nothing for them, no place to stay. They're starving. The Indians fed them, showed them how to feed themselves and make coats and stay warm, and Thanksgiving happened. That's not the story. That's not why the pilgrims gave thanks. That's not why George Washington proclaimed the first Thanksgiving holiday. The Indians did indeed help them. And they learned how to plant corn, and they had a big feast. And we celebrate that today. But Thanksgiving is actually explained in textbooks as a holiday for which the pilgrims gave thanks to the Indians for saving their lives rather than what it was. The pilgrims' Thanksgiving was a thanks to God for helping them in their belief in him and Scripture, into arranging their affairs and forming their colony in a way that ultimately they could survive. And if you doubt this, go look at George Washington's first Thanksgiving proclamation when Thanksgiving became a national holiday. And I've got it here, and I might even share excerpts from it before we're through here today. You cannot escape the fact that Thanksgiving was a national holiday rooted in thanking God for America. That was George Washington's purpose. Thanksgiving was to thank God for America, for everything that had happened leading to the founding of America. Everything. Washington and many of the founders felt divine inspiration throughout the entire period of time following the Pilgrims' arrival. Now, here's the part that's been omitted from the textbooks. Remember that original contract that the Pilgrims all signed aboard the Mayflower? Well, they had merchant sponsors. They didn't have any money. They had people paying them, sponsoring their trip. They didn't have the money to make the trip themselves. These sponsors were in Holland and London. They had to be repaid. So that contract called for everything the Pilgrims produced to go into a common store, a single bank account, if you will. And each member of the community was entitled to an equal share of the gross. This was fair. This was equal. This was same. All the land they cleared, the houses they built, they belonged to the community as well. Nobody owned anything. Everything was owned by the community. Everybody equal share to all of it. They were going to distribute it equally. Everybody would get the same. Everybody would be the same. All the land they cleared, the houses they built, belonged to the community. Nobody owned anything. It was a commune. It was Humboldt County, California. Minus the weed. They even had organic vegetables. Now, William Bradford, who had become the new governor of the colony, recognized that this wasn't working. They weren't making any money to pay off the sponsors. But you know what else was happening? Since everybody got an equal share no matter what, there were some lazy sloths. Yes, some of the original Pilgrims, some of their offspring, just sat around and did nothing all day while the others picked up the slack. And Bradford originally, or at least at some point, saw this isn't going to work. And so they essentially tore up that first contract, which they didn't know it, but that was socialism. And what they did was create a new community based on what we would call capitalism today. The more you produce, the more you got to keep. The harder you work, the greater were the fruits of your labors. If you wanted a bigger home than somebody else, you could afford to build it, you did it. You didn't have to share it. And this change unleashed everything, and the Pilgrims became a going economic concern. And they experienced economic plenty far greater than any they had had under the previous Mayflower contract arrangement. Bradford writes about all of this in his journal. And it is for this that the original Pilgrims gave thanks. Not to the Indians saving them, but to God for helping them to survive and thrive in a place none had ever been. Okay, folks, now here's where this gets good. William Bradford, the governor of the colony, after abandoning the original compact and then converting to, hey, you can keep what you earn and earn as much as you produce, and so when free enterprise was turned loose, in Bradford's journal, this had very good success, for it made all hands industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. In other words, they had economic growth, they had prosperity, because there was personal incentive, rather than everybody getting a share of what others, some, none, not everybody else, produced. And so the Pilgrims found that they had more food than they could eat themselves. Now, this is where what you've been told about Thanksgiving enters the picture. The Indians had more than they could share, the more than they could eat, more food than they could serve each other. They invited the Indians. They set up trading posts. They exchanged goods with the Indians. And the profits finally allowed them to pay off the debts to the sponsors, the merchants in London and Holland who had sponsored them. But it was the sharing of the bounty that was created by the change in governing structure that led to the plenty that allowed them to invite the Indians and share all of this with them. That's the story most people get, but they've been mistaught that the Indians provided all the food because the Pilgrims are incapable. It is the exact opposite. Now, there's just one more element of this, the true story of Thanksgiving. You may or may not have heard of the Great Puritan Migration. That is what happened after the Pilgrim's original 2 or 3 years setting up shop. Now, this is fundamentally important to understand. The Great Pilgrim Migration occurred because of the overwhelming success at growing their community. The word of what the Pilgrims had done spread. I mean, there were ships going back and forth, New World to England and Europe all the time. And word spread of this newfound prosperity, of this new world, of the new opportunities, of the religious freedom and other freedoms that had been created after the arrival of the Pilgrims. Had none of that happened, had the real story of Thanksgiving been that the Pilgrims were a decrepit bunch out of place and didn't know how to take care of themselves, and if it weren't for the Indians, they would have died, there would have been no reason for anybody to follow them. It would have been judged a failure. But it was anything but. And it's not taught today, but the fact of the matter is that the Pilgrims, they were not ideologues. It wasn't that somebody said, we're going to try socialism. It's just the way they set it up. They wanted to be fair with everybody. It was a natural thing. We'll have a common store. Everybody has one share, and everything we do and make goes into that bank, and everybody gets an equal percentage of it. Well, human nature interceded. And there were some lazy people, didn't do anything. They didn't have to. They were entitled to an equal share no matter what they did. That didn't work very long. They set up free enterprise where the fruits of your labor determined what you got, what you had, and what you're able to do. And it formed the basis of forming the basic arrangements they had as a community. Well, it was so successful, and that's what they gave thanks for. These were deeply religious people. They were giving thanks for having been shown the light. And the word spread, and that began the Great Puritan Migration, and that's when the flood of European arrivals began, after the success of the original Plymouth Colony. That's never taught, is part of the original Thanksgiving story. And now you know it. And we, every year, we pass this on because the audience always has new members each and every, well, not just year, each and every month, every day.
And just like with all families, we look forward to creating and building new traditions with our EIB family, inspired by Rush, inspired by you.
Thank you all for being here. We hope you're having a fantastic Thanksgiving so far. Buck will be here tomorrow, and I'll be back with my main man on Monday.
You're enjoying the Best Of program. Here on Thanksgiving Day with Clay Travis and Buck Sexton on the EIB Network.
I know some people seem to not want to give up on the wonderful pandemic, but you know what? It's over. There's always going to be a variant. You shouldn't have to wear masks. It's the Democrats who seem to be, I mean, I travel in every state now, back on the road, and the red states are a joy, and the blue states are a pain in the ass for no reason.
There you go. Welcome back to Clay and Buck Show. That was actually Bill Maher, man of the left, but a man who does see some things clearly, who goes around. Clay, I think unlike a lot of people in the media, a lot of people at CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, Bill, because he does stand-up comedy, he goes to states around the country. It would be amazing if you actually polled the New York Times and Washington Post newsroom. How many of the people that are writing about the country have been outside of the New York or D.C. metro area in the last 18 months? And I think you'd be stunned to find out that, well, actually, probably not. A lot of you know this, but I think it would be stunning to some folks to find that there are so many people that think that they understand the country who don't even go. They don't know what it's like in Texas. Maybe don't even know what it's like in Florida right now. Blue states, a pain in the ass for no reason. I'm in one in New York. And yes, New York City is a pain in the butt about COVID stuff for no good reason. The new mayor, Eric Adams, soon to be new mayor, mayor-elect, just came out and said he'll think about maybe getting rid of the mask mandate in schools. We're supposed to be thankful that our abusers will stop abusing us and our children? Is that how this works? It's the right move, but it's hard to be thankful for it when they're just deciding to stop being so crazy. But understand this, they're not done. They're not done. They want to fight this all the way on the OSHA mandate. What's the point of Congress when you have OSHA? Think about what they did with the CDC. They tried to extend an eviction moratorium using the Centers for Disease Control. Now they're telling you that OSHA can mandate over 100, and we'll get to what happens with less than 100 employee businesses in a moment, over 100 employees, a federal regulatory agency can just say, yeah, you have to get a shot that, not to overstate it, but this is a fact, can harm and even kill you. It is possible. There have been cases of people who have, it's very rare, but who have had adverse reactions to the shot, just like with any pharmaceutical, any intervention. The state's going to make you do this. Ron Klain, as Clay and I like to refer to him, the kind of de facto chief decider, the decider in chief of the United States. Here he is saying, look, if they can make you wear a hard hat on a construction site, they can force a shot on your arm, probably your 5 year old's, arm too. Seven.
Look, these vaccine requirements have been litigated up and down the courts all over the country. State requirements, for example, one in Maine, and every single court before this one ruled that they were valid. The Supreme Court has turned back several times already various efforts to enjoin other vaccine requirements. I'm quite confident that when this finally gets fully adjudicated, not just a temporary order,
right,
the validity of this requirement will be upheld. It's common sense, Chuck. If OSHA can tell people to wear a hard hat on the job,
right,
to be careful on chemicals, it can put in place these simple measures to keep our workers safe.
It's not the same thing, Clay.
It's not the same thing at all. Look, OSHA on the job, if you are working in an asbestos-laden factory, OSHA can come in and determine whether or not your working conditions are safe. But they directly pertain to the working conditions themselves. And also, there's a wide variety of different requirements. I mean, we said it last week. It's 490 pages, these OSHA regulations. And what he's referring to is the Fifth Circuit of the United States, which is traditionally a conservative federal circuit, has suggested that they may stop the enforcement of the Biden vaccine requirement. And I think what that would likely lead to, Buck, is ultimately a conflict among the circuits. And for people out there who don't understand it, our federal courts are set up in a variety of different circuits. And I used to know them all off the top of my head and I'd be able to run through them. But for instance, California is in the Ninth Circuit, Texas, Louisiana, Fifth Circuit. My home state of Tennessee, where I am licensed to practice law, Sixth Circuit. And oftentimes what the Supreme Court ends up doing is when you have conflicting circuit court rulings, which I believe is likely, you'll have the California's, the more liberal circuit court, saying, oh, of course OSHA has the right to do this. And then you'll have more conservative circuits saying they don't. The Supreme Court's going to have to break this tie. And Buck, to me, this is a massive opportunity and also a massive obligation and responsibility for the courts to overrule the federal regulatory state here and not allow OSHA to implement vaccine requirements on the vast majority of the American populace who is going to work. Will they do it? That's the question.
Yeah, I think you've got, right off the bat, you know, you got three votes that are sure as heck going to say, shots every day, forever, you, your kid, they don't care. Whatever the Leviathan wants to do out of D.C. under the Biden administration, you got three Supreme Court justices that are going to say, oh, yeah, that's great. Six that could go either way. I got to tell you, Kavanaugh and Barrett, I don't think they're solid on this one. I don't think they're solid on this one at all.
They need to be. They need to be really solid on saying that this cannot be permitted to occur. And this, by the way, is the kind of Supreme Court opinion that lasts and matters for potentially hundreds of years, because this won't be the last time there is a pandemic in the United States, right?
I think everyone needs to understand that if this is hell, if let's say Ron Klain is right, and it's just like, this is like the morons that were saying at the very beginning,
just like
it's all like seatbelts. Everything is like seatbelts. We can make you do anything. We can make you mask up all day. We can make you stand 6 feet apart. We can make you do jumping jacks because we think it'll be good for your circulation and help you against COVID. That actually would be true, by the way.
I wish they'd mandate exercise instead of mandating vaccines.
But we can do all of that because of seatbelts. That was the argument from the dumb set in the very beginning of this. And they've kind of keep going back to this. If this is true, the federal government can mandate flu shots for everybody, too.
No doubt.
And as we know, flu shots, you know, efficacy is usually 50-60%. And, you know, and at that point, you say, well, what else are they going to mandate for health and safety? Because we've adopted, or at least a big portion of the country has adopted, this zero risk posture about all about all aerosolized and respiratory viruses, will that just extend into the rest of the culture always and forever? They're thinking about combining the COVID and flu shot, Clay.
Well, think about this, Buck. And this didn't get very much attention, but I saw it and I couldn't believe it. Over the weekend, the Florida Gator football team, they got destroyed by South Carolina. Congrats the Gamecocks on a big win. The coach of the Florida Gators, Dan Mullen, came out and said one reason why we lost is because we had 20 to 30 players who had tested positive for the flu. Buck, they all traveled and they played. No restrictions at all in their ability to play in the game. If they had tested positive for COVID instead, which is actually statistically less dangerous to most young people in the country, they would have not only not been able to play, they would have quarantined and they would have had to forfeit. So how in the world are you justifying, even for the virus people out there, 20 or 30 people have the flu, which can spread during games, all the players go and play. And by the way, I think that's fine. But if it had been COVID, they would have shut down the game and canceled it.
It would be fascinating to see an actual, I got some answers on where the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, the little yes. propagandist for the Biden administration pretending to be doing medicine, where the 80%, this is looking at observational studies of N95 mask usage in a clinical setting. So they're pretending that
for people who forgot yesterday or Friday, she said mask wearing would eliminate 80% of COVID,
which
that's
is completely
it's a lie.
Insane. I mean, that's the fact that she says that out loud and doesn't expect to be mocked and ridiculed just shows you where the experts really are at this point. But it would be fascinating to see a study at this stage, and we'll have to go through, I suppose, the winter to really know. I'd be willing to bet that you'll find that the seasonal flu, which people think we might have a pretty bad flu year.
Yes.
I've got a couple friends that are sick right now.
Yeah.
I've had family members
who
are sick.
I think it's spreading pretty significantly.
Definitely stuff going around. Is the flu for a young person more dangerous, because they're not mandating flu shots, than a young person who has the COVID shot or COVID antibodies? I think the answer you're going to find is probably yes.
Yes.
So if we're mandating all this stuff to protect you from COVID, even though your risk as a person in the lower age brackets is very minimal, why wouldn't they mandate it all for the flu? It is incoherent. Incoherent.
How does it ever end? If you're going to start mandating it for the flu and every viral season, kids are going to be wearing masks.
Do you remember
forever?
At the very beginning of all this, Clay, we would say, guys, we had on an average flu season 40, and in a bad flu season 80,000 Americans die a year.
And
we never masked up. We
attention.
Never did all these things. And all they kept saying was, it's so different from the flu. It's going to be. And now we're looking to saying, well, yeah, it's worse for older people and those who are at high risk. But now we're looking at a situation where this is actually kind of like the flu.
Yes.
That's actually where
it's never going to go away. And you're going to have to get a shot every year for the rest of your life.
In case you've forgotten, Fauci is the worst person on the planet. All right, Legacy Box. Simply the best company to preserve your past memories captured on videotape, film, and more. This company, Legacy Box, sends you a box to fill with old home movies and pictures. You send it back and they'll do the rest, digitizing your moments onto a thumb drive, the cloud, or DVD. It's like magic. If you're like most, there's one box in your house that has all those videotapes, film reels, and photos. Each of them contains sentimental, meaningful, irreplaceable moments. Save these from being destroyed by floods or fires. Each item is hand-digitized by a team of over 200 trained technicians right in Tennessee. They've got great online tracking, and they provide you with a dozen emailed updates along the way. Clay, it's amazing. I've done it. I sent in my photos. It was so easy.
Yeah, and right now you're getting early access to a Black Friday sale. Visit legacybox.com/Clay and Buck to unlock a discount for their Black Friday sale. That's legacybox.com/Clay and Buck. Best deal of the year. legacybox.com/Clay and Buck. Welcome back in, Clay Travis, Buck Sexton Show. We should update people, I think, Buck, on what's going on. You can tell me if you've seen anything more recent. We still have an uncertain outcome in New Jersey. This thing can't get any closer than it actually is right now. With 88% reported of the vote in New Jersey, according to the New York Times update, there is 120 votes separating the Republican and the Democrat, with the Republican, who you can pronounce better than me, has a literally 120 vote lead with 2.4 million votes cast.
Yeah, Citarelli.
Are you looking at this? I mean, this is crazy.
Yeah, so it's Citarelli. I think if we were doing it Italian style, it'd be Chiatarelli, but it's yes. Citarelli is the Americanized version, right? People do
all
this
right,
all the
Citarelli.
Time. So it's the,
I mean,
that's
you
the New
wonder
Jersey
whether
version.
Your vote matters. In New Jersey, 120 votes separating the Republican and the Democrat right
everyone
now.
Everyone who listens to us, I believe, or at least who was listening to that point of the show, remember, I think I said yesterday, these are going to be the races. By the way, I believe Youngkin won by a little over 2%.
Yeah.
That's what I said he was going to win by. And I believe I said these are going to be, now granted, I was really just talking about Virginia, but we're seeing in New Jersey too, where you can actually, you go out and vote and it's meaningful because the numbers are so tight. You go, oh wow. I mean, you know, me, my friends, my family members all together. I mean, think 120 vote separation right now in a state the size with millions and millions of people in New Jersey.
Yes.
And this is a blue stronghold state, friends. I know Governor Chris Christie years ago was the governor there, and you can have blue stronghold states with a Republican governor, but this just shows you once again, the other guy, Murphy, had all the Democrat, you know, all the Democrat
big power. No one even talked about this race.
Yeah. What?
Now, hardly anyone even talked about this
race. No one was talking
about it. Was going to be close.
Because everyone thought that he was going to get blown out. But Citarelli went around and said, this is what we got to do. This is what's going on in our state. This is what I will do if you make me the governor. Old school politics. You know, the other guy was going at this. Murphy was going at this with the usual, oh, you know, we're going to have a lot of money and celebrity and we're going to do all this stuff with the Democrat Party just carrying you along. No, right now, people want to know, what are you going to do for me? Because the Democrat Party is coming up zeros for people in a lot of places. And the Biden administration's obviously got Biden. Oh, and I promised everybody a little additional good news.
Yes.
Democrats in Virginia, Virginia Public Access Project had this tweet a couple hours ago. They wrote, we have a corrected result in HD House District 85. This is for the state of Virginia. Instead of a Democratic hold, Republican Karen Greenhalgh has a 202-vote lead over first-term Democrat Alex Askew. So Republicans are now on track in Virginia for a 52-48 lead in the majority in the House, the Virginia State House. So you may have unified red government in the state of Virginia, which, as you have pointed out many times, went for Biden by 10 points a year ago.
And they had not won a statewide race, Buck, since 2009, the Republicans in Virginia, and they may effectively be winning four. The control of the legislature, they've already won the AG, the lieutenant governor, and the governor, a clean sweep in Virginia. And as incredible as the results are in Virginia, New Jersey is the bigger story. Citarelli may not end up winning. Again, he's up by about 120 votes out of 2.4 million that have been cast. I mean, it's almost impossible to have a closer election.
Well, New Jersey's the bigger surprise, maybe. But, I mean, I think Virginia's
yes.
the bigger story.
Bigger, yes. But the bigger, I mean, look, we are now, well, now they just flipped it. Murphy's up like a little bit. So, anyway, this thing is, like, super tight. I think Murphy may end up fighting his way through before all is said and done. But regardless, no one, like we said, hardly even talked about New Jersey. But the sign there, Biden won by 16. We're talking about a state that's effectively dead even right now. And Buck, we talked about yesterday, we said at Virginia, if the Republicans win, and they have, it's going to embolden, you asked this question as we were going to break here a second ago, it's going to embolden a lot of other states that may be slanted towards the Democrats to feel like if they could do it in Virginia, why can't we do it here, especially in 2022?
Well, I mean, this is, there's so much here. And I do remember because I got into conservative media right at the origins around, I mean, Clay, I think we got in around the same time into media, the origins of the Tea Party movement and how that was about people at the local level understanding, hey, we can come together and we actually have political voice. We actually can turn elections one way or the other if we get involved. And school board meetings and what's being taught to your kids really matters to people, not just in Virginia, all over the country. And you heard Youngkin saying, let's not cede the public school system to the lunatics. Let's not only have people on the right talking about homeschooling and taking your kids out of the system entirely. Let's create more choice. Let's create a better system. Let's allow parents to pick where their kids are going. Let's work to make the system better as it stands now with conservative principles instead of just abandoning it. That's a message that can resonate, I think, across all 50 states.
No doubt at all. I mean, it is such a fabulous day to wake up and be in favor of American exceptionalism. You talked about, Buck, sometimes we have to sit down and we have to talk about all the idiocy of Fauci or whatever the latest restrictions are. I'll be damned if it didn't feel great to sit down in front of this mic and start off the show this first hour talking about a huge, massive ass-kicking that we put on Democrats in Virginia. More to come.
Yeah.
Clay and Buck.
It's fun. I got to say, man, Virginia made us proud. Even Jersey. Hey, Jersey, you're making us proud, Jersey.
You're listening to Clay Travis and Buck Sexton on the EIB Network.